Hello, and welcome to this week's HSJ Health Check podcast. I'm your host, Annabelle Collins, and this week I'm joined by Bureau Chief and Northwest Correspondent Lawrence Dunhill, Senior Correspondent Sharon Brennan, and our Southeast Correspondent Alison Moore. This week, the Northwest has continued to dominate the news. This time, it's all about the ongoing Tier 3 funding row in Greater Manchester, confusion around capacity in the region, and disbelief at the NHS's failure to be open about the scale of COVID admissions. Lawrence, I think you've been a much needed voice of reason as to what's going on in the Northwest this week. It feels like frustration has really been growing since the podcast last week, and I'm wondering what the main sticking points have been from your perspective.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch and quite confusing over the last week with Burnham, kind of Andy Burnham, the Greater Manchester Mayor, standing up to the government over the going into Tier 3 and how much financial support that they get. I suppose the consequences of that was that both sides were trying to use NHS data for to support their own argument. So it meant that there was quite a lot of confusing information that was being put out. And a lot of journalists were trying to get hold of official information. And as we know, the NHS isn't kind of all that forthcoming with that sort of thing. And the Manchester Evening News actually ran an unusual front page at the start of the week, where they were talking about NHS secrecy and shaming them for the fact that they were being less than transparent with this important information. And it does seem to have created a bit of a clamour for amongst MPs and other kind of influential voices for more to be published. And so I think watch this space. The devolution team in Greater Manchester suddenly kind of sent out an alert on Tuesday or Wednesday saying we are working on this urgently. But that, you know, they better hurry up because the news agenda is going to move on pretty quick. And in terms of what the situation actually is in Greater Manchester, it's kind of generally not quite as bad as most of the reports. There's around 600 COVID patients in their hospitals. That compares to about 1,000 in the April peak. And it's about 12% of their normal capacity. And in terms of critical care, they've got about 200 patients compared to about 300 in the first peak. About 50 beds currently available, but with the ability to then surge that much higher to sort of, in theory, to kind of like 800-900. But obviously there'd be lots of staff who would be very concerned if it got even close to that. The situation in GM is bad, but it's not nearly as bad as it is in Liverpool, actually, which has kind of surprisingly had less of the headlines because their local negotiations seem to be to go much smoother than the Greater Manchester one. And so Liverpool, it currently has more patients in its hospitals than it did in the April peak, around 400, and that's more than 20% of capacity, which is kind of getting to the level where that's going to have a really serious impact on their non-urgent electives. And I suspect it might start having an impact on some urgents and cancer care as well.
Sorry, I was just going to ask around Liverpool, are we seeing an impact on electives and urgent care already?
We certainly are on non-urgents, not sure yet on urgent electives or cancer, but those were cancelled. Cancer procedures were cancelled in the peak in April, so I'd be surprised if that didn't happen again to some extent.
Mm-hmm. And just getting into the politics a little bit, I was wondering why the situation in Manchester has seemed so much more fraught than in Liverpool. And from my perspective, it feels that Liverpool, I've just not seen Liverpool being covered in the same way as it was last week. And as you say, the situation there is pretty dire. Yeah. I'm just wondering why that might be.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? I suppose it just comes down to the politics in that Greater Manchester felt like it should get more money because much of that region has been subject to stricter lockdown measures over the summer that weren't in place in Liverpool. And so I think their rationale was that they felt that their businesses had been harder hit, and therefore to go through further pain, they would need more support.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that Manchester could go up to a surge of 800 or 900 beds. That would be the very worst case scenario.
Yeah, and that's very much a kind of theoretical number of what they think they could do. In the peak in April, they only had 300 patients in, but the numbers were so scary coming from Italy that they thought they had to at least double their capacity. So it's yet to be tested, but that's in their plans that they could potentially scale to that level. I would have thought cancel almost everything else, apart from emergency care.
Yeah, absolutely. And would that be worse than the initial peak, if that kind of level of surge was needed?
Yeah, much worse. It would be sort of three times worse. If they had 900 critical care patients, that'd be three times worse than the 800.
And how does the Nightingale play into this? I think it was Steve Powis who said that they were now being kind of ready to mobilise, and I think it was Dave who sort of suggested that might have been a bit of a PR move to send the signal to the public that things are serious again. But I'm wondering, that's got a slightly different model to kind of what it was when it was first set up.
Yeah, well, it's a different model to the original London one.
Okay, right. Yeah.
The Manchester one is step down. It's not going to provide critical care, who knows? It may well be, if we do see hundreds and hundreds more patients needing critical care, and therefore recovery from that, it may be used. But at the moment, kind of attitudes are still the same as they were before, in that the trust don't really want to send their staff there because they don't think it's that appropriate for patients. But I think if we start to see infections in care homes and deaths in care homes, and a push to try and protect those more by not discharging hospital patients, people are going to have to go somewhere. And so it might yet see the light of day, I suppose.
That's actually quite interesting, Lawrence, because that's one of the most contentious things that came up in the winter care social plan. There was a line in it about CCGs and local authorities having to work together to provide alternative accommodation for patients who have either still got COVID or haven't yet had their test back. And if a care home says they cannot barrier nurse that person, it's down to the CCG and the local authority to provide an alternative accommodation for that person to go to. So I suppose potentially, Lawrence, that could well be a Nightingale. Although, again, maybe Annabelle, you can answer this as our staffing expert. It strikes me as quite difficult for those Nightingales to take that role, because it would need an awful lot of not just PPE but staff to be able to make sure that those patients aren't, are well looked after and not passing on the infection.
No, absolutely, and also it just seems as an environment for kind of recuperation. Pretty terrible. I don't know. It seems like it would, yeah, incredibly difficult to staff that sort of thing.
For those listeners who don't follow Lawrence on Twitter, and you should do, Annabelle and I learned an amazing fact from him the other day that it takes 2 weeks to heat up these Nightingales. So the heating's been on for how long is it now? 10 days, Lawrence, will they?
Yeah, must be.
Something like, well, that's the Manchester one. I don't know about the others, because the Manchester one, although it's a conference centre normally, it was an old train station.
Yeah. I've been reminded of many conferences in there being absolutely freezing, wearing my coat for the entire time. So yeah, maybe they should have put the heating on a bit earlier in September.
Yeah, we all know it well because of the NHS conference event. That's
too well, went it too well.
And also the Conservative conferences taking place there as well.
That's right.
That will be interesting. Although maybe it'll be another year of virtual conferences. Who knows? They might be hoping it is.
I think there's also something to add, if you don't mind, about Lawrence's view on bed capacity and what might take it, what might add to the surge. There's been quite an interesting row over shielding that we were looking at quite closely in Liverpool. So obviously for those listeners who need reminding, people who were seen as clinically extremely vulnerable, so that's those with severe chest conditions, though some people who had cancer, some people who've had organ transplants, were told to shield from March the 29th for, I think it ended up being 14 weeks. And that meant pretty much not going out of your house. That was done obviously to protect those people, also to protect pressure on the NHS. And it doesn't look like shielding is going to be reinstated this time round. So obviously on a personal level, a lot of people who are living in Liverpool and or Manchester who have those severe conditions are incredibly concerned about their own health. Because as the rules stand, it recommends people in tier three who are extremely vulnerable to COVID to not go to the shops and not travel on transport, but go to work if you can't work from home. So theoretically, you can be in a position where you work in Sainsbury's and you have to go because that's your job, you need an income, but you're told not to shop there afterwards because that would be detrimental to your health, which obviously is an actual nonsense of the news, of the rules, and whether or not they then change to protect people better, we don't know. But I think what's quite interesting for the NHS and that no one's really looked at is there's most of those people who shielded didn't get COVID because they were shielding. What we don't know is if they then do catch COVID because they can't shield for financial reasons or family caring reasons, what happens to them if they catch it? So actually you could end up with a cohort of quite severely ill patients with COVID, which we didn't see in wave one because they were financially protected from having to leave the house. So I think it'd be quite interesting to see the impact that might have on resources from an NHS point of view, without going to the ethical issue of whether or not people should be protected to have that protection given to them again.
It does seem very odd, doesn't it, that shielding hasn't been properly reinstated there, Sharon? Like, as someone who's shielded yourself, how would you feel now if you were in Liverpool?
I think the main problem is it comes down to an issue of inequality. I have a very nice boss who lets me work from home. And I have a very nice home to work in, and I have a job that can be done from home. So effectively, I can shield myself and I don't have to choose between income and my health. If you are working in a sector where you cannot work from home and your boss doesn't see you, doesn't want to give you a job that can be done from home or be more protected, then you are effectively choosing between income and health. And most people, for that, then that's not a choice. They don't have an income that they can rely on if they don't go to work. So I think for me, it's just a question of equality. And, we saw in wave one that those people who were poorer or did what, were traditionally called blue collar work, such as taxi drivers and bus drivers, were much more likely to have died from COVID. And now we will work out whether the same kind of inequality applies to those who are shielding. I spoke to one of the Liverpool councillors, Paul Brandt, and he said to me that, shielding should be reinstated for those high-risk workers so that they have the financial support to do so. And you're really probably not talking about that many people. So I think overall 2.2 million people were asked to shield in the first round. I think roughly 1 million of those were of working age and had a job. How many of those are in Manchester and Liverpool, and how many of those are doing a job that they can't do from home? I mean, you, when you start breaking it down, it's thousands that need support, not millions. So it does seem quite unfair that they can't extend some kind of financial support to those specific, very small numbers of people, especially because they've not probably thought through the knock-on effect to the NHS. I mean, the cost of looking after those people if they did get COVID would probably outstrip the cost of supporting them to remain at home for a period of time. But whether or not that those shielding rules change because of pressure on the government remains to be seen, really.
Sharon, you said you spoke to a councillor in Liverpool about this. Has there been kind of a disagreement, kind of a political disagreement around whether to introduce shielding in the region?
Well, Lawrence and I spoke to a few people off record around the area, and pretty much because shielding involves national budget. So it involves, so the press release that came out from DHSC said that if Shildon was reimposed, they would restart the food packages, which we know has cost a lot of money. And also people may be entitled to statutory sick pay or employment support allowance, which is the benefit you get if you can't work because of your health. So it does actually, you know, increase national budget. So because of that, we were told that in Liverpool, though people involved in public health couldn't really go near the issue of Shildon because it's seen a national issue, not a local issue, which again, I think comes down to the problem we started off with that Lawrence opened up with was how much local input do local areas get into these decisions? Because obviously Liverpool will know themselves what, the needs of their own area and what they can do without financial support and what they can't do without financial support. So, there was very little discussion around Shildon. It was very much being told this is a national issue that we will decide on.
Mm. Do you think, because I remember in the recent press conference, Jonathan Van Tam said that he hopes that some regions put other measures in place. Could that also extend to something like Shildon, do you think? Could a region like Liverpool or Manchester or, you know, other areas, Nottingham, that I do want to talk about briefly, put Shildon back into place as a regional measure to protect people?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know, Lawrence, if you know more about it. I do know that originally Manchester had asked for £90 million to help support its residents in Tier 3, and apparently that was a costed plan. Whether or not that included some element of financially supporting those who needed the shield, I don't know. And I don't know, Lawrence, if you do. But yeah, you could see some form of Shildon coming in on a local level. But the question would be, how do you pay for it? Because sick pay and employment support allowance are national benefits run and delivered by the government. So I have to wrap my head around how you would give that financial support on a local level without that structure in place. I don't know.
It's interesting. We seem to be arguing over relatively small amounts of money at the moment. The £5 million in Greater Manchester between the government and Andy Burnham's demands money to support a few thousand people shielding, and yet at the same time we've said expect to spend billions on PPE, track and trace and so forth. We seem to have gone from one extreme to another, arguing over what is relatively small amounts of money for a government.
Absolutely, a real tack change from money is no object. I think just a last few points on kind of the immediate risks of COVID. I think I mentioned just now that I wanted to just quickly mention Nottingham, kind of moving down the country. It's quite interesting because in the first peak, Nottingham was didn't have a too difficult time. I think there were less than 100 deaths in 100,000 people. But now it seems to be very different, particularly centred around Nottingham University Hospitals, the more kind of urban bit of Nottinghamshire. Speaking to people in Sherwood Forest, they don't seem to be experiencing quite the same pressures. And I think that's quite interesting. I don't know whether you would agree, but trusts that often have a difficult winter anyway seem to be in kind of a more pressurised position at the moment. For me, NUH is one of the trusts that I kind of know every winter. Often they'll declare a black alert and they have a real problem with bed shortages every winter, and this just seems to be exacerbating it. And I think it would be quite interesting, Alison, just on the southeast. We've seen, levels in the southeast have been pretty low so far, but you've started to notice a trend, a slight uptick in the region, is that right?
Yes, I think we've been seeing rising number of cases for a few weeks now, but now we're in the position of seeing quite a lot of hospitalisations of people, and again, those numbers are moving up quite dramatically. I think in the last few days, they've gone from about 240 to 319. Obviously, not yet at a level that you could compare with Manchester or Liverpool, but a worrying trend nonetheless. And talking to people around the area, there's growing concern in hospitals, beginning to see some hospitals restricting visiting because they've got some wards now down with COVID. They're thinking that they may have to have more COVID wards by the end of the week. And there is even a school of thought which says to maintain doing elective work, we might have to declare a hospital as an elective only hospital and direct COVID patients, and I imagine a lot of A&E patients elsewhere. So what has started in the north and bits of the Midlands does seem to me to be spreading to those areas which have so far seemed to have been fairly fireproof.
Interesting. And I think switching from talking around the immediate risks of COVID, moving on to kind of unintended consequences, and this is something we talk about quite a lot in this podcast. But this week, it's focused on a story, Alison and Lawrence, you published this week on HSJ. It's looking at heightened death rates at home during the pandemic, with the highest excess deaths found in the southeast of England. It's really interesting findings in the data. Alison and Lawrence, I'm just wondering, you noticed this strange pattern. Do you have any idea what's going on here?
That's a good question. I don't know that anyone has any great idea what's going on. Lawrence crunched the numbers and they certainly seem to show that there is a large number of excess deaths. And by excess, I think it's fair to say we compared with the figures over the last 5 years, so the official ONS measurement, but they are concentrated in the southeast. Lawrence can probably give you some indication of the extent of that.
Yeah, so the kind of odd trend that we noticed was that over the most recent 10-week period to the end, to the start of October, the southeast had had almost 900 excess deaths, whereas and that was 10 per 100,000 population, and the next highest was the northeast with around 3 per 100,000. So a much lower rate, and then the other regions were lower than the northeast. So it really sticks out. But I think Alison and I both contacted a lot of kind of public health experts, including locally, and didn't have much luck with in terms of people understanding it or even being aware of it. Actually, a lot of local people said, "Well, we use different figures." Which might be fair enough, but this is that these were the kind of official definitions of excess deaths and what the ONS and the Public Health England data was showing. So it's definitely kind of one to watch, I think, to see if it continues.
Yes, there's no obvious explanation. Obviously, there are bits of the southeast that are more deprived than others. There's bits with a different age profile. But that hasn't changed significantly in the last year, or possibly even in the last 5 years. People seem to really struggle with this concept that we were comparing like with like, to be honest. And there was a bit of clamming up going on amongst some of the NHS bodies. Probably shouldn't say a great deal more about that, but unfortunately some areas wouldn't talk to me and deferred to the regional office of NHS England. Mm. It is odd, and the figures are quite large. I mean, over the 10-week period, Sussex saw 280 extra deaths in the home. So 28 people a week dying at home, who you perhaps wouldn't expect to when compared with previous years.
Do we know of what, Alison?
We don't know.
Mm. I mean, what we do know, so this has been well done to my colleagues for finding this anomaly, especially when their own, when you go to people in that area who live there and, public health experts who didn't see it themselves. But this has been part of an issue that has been rising since March, that HSJ has been covering since June. And that's that COVID has pretty much massively increased the number of people who've died at home. So I think it was about 40% in May or June of all deaths were occurring in the house, in private homes. And now it's about a third. Third higher than the 5-year average, and an ONS report came out this week about this issue, and it said that whereas other higher rates of death have fallen back below the 5-year average, say for deaths in hospitals or other settings, the private home deaths has remained consistently high. They've suggested correlations, so for example, heart disease, people are more likely, they've seen an increase of people dying from heart problems at home and a subsequent decrease of them dying at hospital. But what no one can really get to the bottom of is why. And I, you know, I've been talking to various people. I'm not sure we're ever going to get the answer because, you know, for example, if you look at inpatient deaths, there is a national audit of end of life care for inpatient deaths, and there's no such thing that exists in the community. So there's no real tracking of what was going on here. And there's, it raises quite a few big questions for the NHS looking forward. One of them is was raised by Nuffield Trust itself in response to the ONS report. It said we don't know what these deaths were like. So the statement was there needs to be a better understanding of the role that patient choice or reluctance to access health services play in the stark increase of deaths in private homes, which means, you know, did people choose to die at home because that's what they preferred, or did they do it almost as a negative choice because what they didn't want to do was die in a care home or in hospital without the ability to have visitors there, which obviously we saw, you know, is a huge issue in COVID and just reminding us and still is going on in care homes that, you know, they really people aren't allowed in at the moment. But what we don't know is why, and we also don't know if this is a trend that's going to continue. And without really any kind of investigation into why these deaths happened, whether it's choice or whether it was fear of the NHS or whether it was indeed, as Alison mentioned earlier to me, people dying at home who wouldn't have done if they'd been more willing to access health services during COVID, is really hard to plan going forward of how to respond to this data. So some people have suggested this could be, the, you know, to me, that this could be one of the kind of fallouts of COVID, is that now we have more people wanting to die at home and that this could be a consistent trend. If that's so, the NHS needs to start thinking about how it pivots its services to allow that. So how many palliative care services are offered at home, how well trained social care workers are that go in to help people, how well trained they are in palliative care, how well GPs can kind of provide, you know, GP services in someone's house for that kind of end of life stage. And it, you know, it raises a huge amount of issues about where the NHS should be looking to move. And yet no one has done any work on causes of these deaths or what care, quality of care people got when they were dying at home. So it's very hard to ever to understand what was going on here. And I'm not sure if we ever will understand unless there is some formal inquiry, which I haven't yet heard of anything from the government or CQC as to, you know, what was happening in this period of time to people.
That's very interesting. A couple of HSJ readers have said to me that perhaps one factor was lack of input from community services, from people who were at home anyhow, had perhaps had a long-term condition and were getting regular visits from community services. And I was given a couple of examples, one in the southeast, one actually elsewhere, where this hadn't happened once COVID had started to bite. Now that's possibly that meant that a deterioration in their condition went unnoticed, and people who would not be classified normally as end of life sort of drifted into that and subsequently died at home. But I can't see why that would happen more in the southeast, which as far as I know has reasonable community health services, than it would in other areas of the country.
And I think that highlights an issue as well. There's just such a lack of data around community services and patients' experience of that. Yes. If you look at the referral to treatment target, that's an in-hospital assessment that actually tracks like when people are asked for treatment and when they get it. We have nothing similar like that in the community. You know, on a bit of a side note, but if you start moving into integrated care systems, as we, you know, from April 2020, all the whole area is meant to be one, it's very hard to imagine how they can reconfigure care pathways so there's greater involvement of the community if they don't actually have the data of what's needed out there and what people's experience has been to date. So I think this is showing up quite an interesting issue, not only with overall how the NHS manages its community services, but also, you know, is there going to be a trend to rethink how we wish to die as a nation? And we don't really talk about that much, but maybe one of the last things to say is that hospices that still remain majoritively charitably funded. So if there's a pivot towards not having people in hospices or in care homes and having people at home, that is going to cost an awful lot more because obviously it's individual visits, especially if the PPE, et cetera, needs to be worn. So I do think it's opened up a big question. And I'd be interested from any listeners if they've got any answers as to what was going on either nationally or specifically in the area of South East, which Lawrence and Alison have revealed with their research.
Thank you, Shani. Yeah, I think it's interesting. It seems to be that grey area between NHS and social care that often gets forgotten about. Yeah, you can, anyone listening, you can get in touch with Sharon and Alison with any more information around this. And on that note, I think we're going to have to draw the podcast to a close this week. So if you enjoyed us, do join us again next week. I can assure you there's no better place to get your health policy news. You can find us on the HSJ website and all main podcast channels. And don't forget to share and subscribe if you haven't already. Thank you, Sharon, Lawrence and Alison, and to listeners. And we'll see you next week.